Yeah.
Good evening. It gives me great pleasure on behalf of the Isaac and Tamara Deutscher Memorial Prize Committee to welcome you all here for what has been an annual event for some, I think, 26 years. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Dr. Justin Rosenberg. For doing so, as is conventional on these occasions, it is my pleasure to announce the winner of this year's prize. I should explain that Justin Rosenberg is the winner of the prize awarded in 1994. The winner of the 1995 prize is distinguished, the former member of the committee, but well known in many other respects, Eric Hobsbawm, for his book Age of Extremes. And Eric will be delivering the lecture this time next year, I hope in this place, on the topic related to this book, which I'm sure is familiar to all of us. Well, this evening's prize winner has not concerned himself merely with one century, but with many centuries of the international system, and has produced a book which I'm sure many of you have read, which I certainly consider to be one of the most important books published in the field of international relations for many a long year. And it was the committee's great pleasure unanimously to decide on the award of this prize to Justin Rosenberg. It's well known to many of us as a colleague here at the LSE. Prior to that, he was a student both in sociology and before that of literature. And I think his book is one of the most challenging that it has been our pleasure to consider in many a long year. Justin Rosenberg.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin by expressing my thanks to the Deutscher Committee for the great honor of this award. The Isaac and Tamara Deutscher Memorial Prize is, I think, a uniquely valuable institution in many ways, but the most valuable aspect of it, surely, is the legacy of Isaac Deutscher himself. Deutscher wasn't just another Marxist. He was one of the most eloquent of those who kept alive the critical spirit of classical Marxism at a time when that spirit was being stifled on both sides of the Cold War. I think that for that alone, the present generation of socialists is indebted to him. But Deutscher also did it with great personal and intellectual flair. And for that reason, his memorial lecture, by recalling the spirit of the man, also uniquely provides a great annual opportunity. The opportunity to restate in the confident tones of Deutscher himself the enormous enduring strengths of the Marxist understanding of the contemporary world. And it's that opportunity which I'd like to take up this evening by discussing my own field, the field of international relations theory, for which, as I'm going to argue, the legacy of Deutscher has a special relevance. There's something very peculiar about international relations as a theoretical branch of intellectual learning. In all the period of its existence, the systematic reflection on the nature of relations between states seems to have produced no great books, to have inspired no classics of the political or historical imagination. In moral terms, it has appeared to be unable to rise to a positive, progressive statement of human existence, and as a field of theoretical endeavor, it has proved again and again to be an intellectual dead end. In short, as a body of writings, international theory is marked not only by paucity, but also by intellectual and moral poverty. I'm sure that many of you will recognize those quotations. They come not from the ruminations of an embittered dissident, but from one of the discipline's most celebrated exponents, namely Martin White. Writing in the late 1950s, White concluded that after four centuries of the existence of the state system, there was still what he described as a vacuum in international theory, a vacuum which contrasted strikingly with the wealth of domestic political theories of the state which had grown up over the same period. How had such a peculiar state of affairs come about? Martin White had his own explanation for this. It was a consequence, he argued, not of the deficiencies of individual writers, but rather of the nature of the subject matter itself. In a famous distinction, he asserted that political theory and law are the theory of the good life, international theory is the theory of survival. What he meant by this was that within its national borders, a society had some freedom to choose its own path of development, a choice which a political theory might serve to frame. But beyond those borders, in its relations with other societies, the need to survive in a potentially hostile environment imposed its own imperatives, which must ultimately override the moral requirements of any political theory. So what then are these imperatives which determine the actual behavior of states, and where do they come from? Martin White's answer to this echoes the premise of all orthodox international theory. I quote, "So long as the absence of international government means that powers are primarily preoccupied with their survival, so long will they seek to maintain some kind of balance between them." And it is, on his account, this necessary pursuit of the balance of power which produces both the evacuation of moral choice and the drastic descriptive simplification of the behavior of states. Because, as he put it, international politics is consequently the realm of recurrence and repetition. It is the field in which political action is most regularly necessitous. So, all in all, if the balance of power was the masterpiece of international politics in a practical sense, it was nonetheless also the root cause of what he called a kind of recalcitrance of international politics to being theorized about. And the moral and intellectual poverty of international theory was therefore a necessary and irremediable poverty. Is that it then? Should we just give up hope of anyone ever writing great works of international theory? Those of us who work in this field need, I think, to keep reminding ourselves of what a curious outcome to the development of our discipline all this represents. If, as Martin White argued, international theory has had an impoverished imagination, can this really be the result of its subject matter? After all, when you think about it, it's at the international level that the extraordinary drama of modernity rises up to its full height. It's at this level, and at this level alone, that we can glimpse the process of the capitalist transformation of humanity as a whole. The rise of the West, the engulfing of the non-European world, the globalizing of the sovereign state system and the world market, and the mighty world wars and revolutionary struggles which this development has brought in its train. How could a discipline which in this sense occupies the terrain of world history as its home ground fail to rise to such a stirring theme? In fact, it seems to me that faced with this epic character of its subject matter, one is forced to ask whether the cause of the stunted development of international theory, in fact, lies elsewhere. What if Martin White had it the wrong way round? What if the problem lies not in the subject matter, but rather in the intellectual shape of the discipline itself, and in the ideas through which it wrestles with what Deutscher called this heaving chaos of a world? Above all, I think, one would then have to ask whether the intellectual centrality of the balance of power itself, which Martin White thought was simply the result of a brutal reality, has in fact been the major cause of the theoretical underdevelopment of international theory. It's that proposition, and more importantly, the question of what alternative framework might exist, which I want to explore this evening. Now, the weaknesses of balance of power theory as a general theory of international politics are familiar enough. For my purposes, however, the main one that I want to focus on can be seen if we ask ourselves how a man with such a deep and impressive historical sense as Martin White had could nonetheless write that whether we look at the international politics of the 16th century or the 20th century, We find, in his words, the same old melodrama of the balance of power. In this world-weary phrase, the sense of history, not as the accumulating clutter of events and dates, but as the making and remaking of the human world, is surely expiring. And the most dramatic history of all, the one which produced the modern international system in which we all live, the real history of international relations, has already been lost, leaving behind the vacuum in international theory. The lost history of international relations. How to get it back? Well, much has changed, of course, in the 35 years since Martin White issued his sigh of intellectual resignation. And his conclusions have been challenged from many directions. But what I don't think has yet materialized is the overall theoretical redefinition. The alternative big picture to the balance of power, the single simple idea which would fundamentally reorient international theory, not by adding yet another critique of the balance of power, but by finally replacing it at the defining apex of the discipline. Which brings us to the $64,000 question. Can there be such an alternative framework? A framework which has the same intuitive simplicity as the balance of power, but which enables us, at long last, to recover the lost history of international relations, where the balance of power has shown us only an empty, meaningless struggle for domination. I think that there can. In fact, I'm going to argue that not only does such a framework already exist, but it's one in whose intellectual application Isaac Deutscher played an important role. The framework I'm referring to goes under the name of uneven and combined development. It is associated most famously with the writings of Leon Trotsky. And I want to use the rest of this evening's lecture to explain why, although I'm not myself a Trotskyist politically, and although I don't hold with Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution, I nonetheless believe that the theory of uneven and combined development is a key to recovering the lost history of international relations. Like all great intellectual advances, the theory of uneven and combined development has a retrospective simplicity, which makes you wonder why it wasn't formulated at an earlier date. The starting point is a straightforward empirical observation that the historical world of capitalism in which we live did not appear simultaneously everywhere out of the same social and cultural conditions. On the contrary, it appeared, first of all, in the northwestern corner of Europe and spread outwards into a surrounding world of many different kinds of pre-existing culture and society. For this reason, it's impossible to speak of capitalist world development today without presupposing an international history of expansion and incorporation. Now, this global expansion of capitalism was, of course, anticipated by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto of 1848. But the image presented there was, in fact, not an international one, but rather a transnational one. In that image, capitalism would spread from one country to the next like a brush fire, consuming whatever cultures it found in its way, and reducing all societies to the same basic contradiction of bourgeois and proletarian. The fact that the world was divided into separate political communities did not materially affect the texture of this historical process. The barriers separating the communities were going to be battered down by the heavy artillery of cheap commodities, and all pre-existing societies, whatever their character, would in any case be dissolved. Capital was going to create a world in its own image. As we know, things didn't quite turn out that way. In fact, what Trotsky saw half a century later, above all when he looked at his own native land of Russia, was that countries outside Western Europe were certainly being dragged into the process of capitalist development, but they were not following the classical path to modernity supposedly taken by England and France. Somehow, capital was not creating a world in its own image. The reason for this lay partly in the historical unevenness of human social development. The world overrun by the Europeans in the 18th and 19th centuries was made up of many different societies, from the Stone Age tribes of North America to the ancient empires of the East, which had for centuries been more materially advanced than Europe. That on its own meant that capitalist world development would proceed from many different starting points and find different cultural obstacles to overcome in each case. And in fact, this applied in some respects just as much within Europe as outside it. But it wasn't just a question of different starting levels. Trotsky saw that even once all these societies were incorporated into an international system, it still didn't follow that they would develop in such a way so as all to converge at some future destination in advanced liberal democracy. There was something about the way capitalism was spreading which pointed in a very different direction. It's here, I think, that Trotsky made his great theoretical advance. And he did so precisely by reintroducing into this historical process its specifically international dimension. The key, he argued, was quite simply that the development of backward societies took place under the pressure of an already existing world market dominated by more advanced capitalist powers. A really simple empirical observation, but one which turned out to have paradoxical consequences. The paradox of this observation is that on the one hand, it means that technology and investment are available internationally so that late developers don't have to retrace the whole path of scientific research and slow capital accumulation taken by their predecessors. And Trotsky could see that partly by this leapfrogging of technical stages, Germany and the United States were already overtaking England economically. On the other hand, this same privilege of backwardness, as he called it, carried a price, potentially a very heavy price, in the peculiar contortions of social structure to which it gave rise. In the particular case of Tsarist Russia, the state orchestration of industrialization had led to the emergence of a growing, though highly localized, working class in the major cities. But precisely because of this central role of the state and the dominance of foreign investment, there was no corresponding rise of a politically confident indigenous bourgeoisie. That meant, on the one hand, that industrial conflicts were becoming directly political, provoking the state into more and more repressive forms. On the other hand, the supposed historical agent of liberalization, namely the bourgeoisie, was in this case so small and insecure that it was repeatedly drawn instead into the arms of the autocratic state as the only guarantor of property and order. Meanwhile, however, the vast bulk of the population, the peasantry, remained formally outside this degenerating urban process. Outside, but by no means unconnected, because the deepening international indebtedness of the state caused it to lean ever more heavily on the peasants for taxation, in effect converting them, in Trotsky's image, into tributaries of the stock exchanges of the world. In turn, that outside world now had an interest in the continued survival of the archaic Tsarist state, which was the only guarantee of debt repayments, the more so as the internal Russian opposition was driven into more and more radical political forms. What on earth was going on here? Was this a capitalist state, or did it remain pre-capitalist? Trotsky's answer, in effect, is that it was neither. What was happening was that the international pressures of uneven development were driving Russia into a combined pattern of development. They were leading to the fusion of the old and the new, an unstable sociological amalgam of Western and Russian elements with its own peculiar developmental tendencies. And the more Russia was integrated externally into the international system by these means, the more its internal social structure was being twisted into a shape that actually prevented it from developing along the path taken by the liberal states of Western Europe. This led Trotsky to his famous pronouncement, England in her day revealed the future of France, considerably less of Germany, but not in the least of Russia and not of India. Read through the history of capitalist development in England, all the sociological coordinates in Tsarist Russia were completely askew. But that was precisely Trotsky's point. To read it in that way would be to suppress the international process of uneven and combined development which forms its actual historical matrix. And Russia, of course, was not alone, since by definition almost all countries except Britain would share this condition of relative backwardness. Combined development was going to be not the exception, but the norm. Once this point is seen, all unilinear models of social development necessarily fall by the wayside. The centrality of international relations to understanding any national path of development in the modern world becomes apparent, and the social integument of the international system itself is finally laid bare. Let me try and explain what I mean by this, by spelling out three implications of all this for international theory. First of all, as we've seen, capital did indeed create one world, but not a homogeneous world, fashioned in the image of the capitalist societies at its center. To understand why that is so, we have to grasp the peculiar international mechanism of capitalist expansion, which, even as it incorporates other societies, twists them, fuses with them, in unpredictable combinations. It follows, I think, that if we want to understand what the international system is today, then we cannot begin with a logical model of homogeneous states. The variety of political forms is simply too great. We would have to begin instead with a historical analysis which reconstructs this uneven and combined development of capitalism internationally, which has actually produced such a variegated world of states. But secondly, the need to conduct this historical analysis carries us, I think, beyond the political structure of the state system and requires us to visualize what Trotsky called the social structure of humanity. This phrase sounds rather abstract, but Trotsky meant something very precise and concrete by it. He meant the actual interrelation of all these different societies by virtue of which they made up a larger dynamic whole. The contradictory but irreversible unity of human social development created by the spread of the world market and all the tensions and conflicts arising from this geopolitically combined but sociologically uneven development of the international system. Within that totality, the state system is a crucial but by no means freestanding element. On the contrary, their historical and geographical location within this social structure of humanity is what enables us to explain why the English, German, and Russian states took on such different political forms. Furthermore, according to Trotsky, it's this same overall social structure of humanity which the great powers are dragged by their own interests into managing geopolitically. Because if the capitalist penetration of Russia distorted Russian society, it also, by the same token, incorporated that social distortion into the political structure of the world market. We thus see, wrote Trotsky in 1906, that the world bourgeoisie has made the stability of its state system profoundly dependent on the unstable pre-bourgeois bulwarks of reaction. The uneven and combined development of capitalism therefore expresses itself at the interstate level as a problem of geopolitical order. Thirdly, if that is so, then what would be the specific contribution of international theory to the attempt by the social sciences to understand the modern world? It would, I think, be to see this process as a dynamic and historical whole, It would be to show how the fate of the international system reflects and organizes at the level of world politics that uneven and combined sociological development of capitalism, which is its actual substance and which comprises, in fact, the central defining event of modern world history. With that last move, I think, I hope, we have filled Martin White's vacuum in international theory with the world historical sociology of modernity. And in doing so, I now want to argue, we have also found the key to the lost history of international relations. Let me give you the gist of my argument before I launch into it. At first sight, the course of 20th century history appears to diverge dramatically from any Marxist understanding. In particular, the socialist revolutions which were predicted in the industrialized heartlands of capitalism never occurred. Instead, even more alarmingly, they took place in the peasant periphery, where they weren't supposed to happen. Socialism itself then turned out not to be the realm of human freedom, but rather a brutal authoritarianism, just one more of those tyrannies which have challenged the civilized liberal world and sought to overthrow the balance of power. And far from being the historical successor to capitalism, socialism was finally defeated by it in the Cold War, thus proving that there is no higher form of society than liberal capitalism. Marx has therefore been decisively refuted by nothing less than the passage of history. Not only do I dispute this conclusion, I think it rests upon a fundamental misreading of what has been happening in the 20th century. And I want to argue that just as the apparently anomalous pattern of Russian development under Tsarism makes sense as soon as one grasps the uneven and combined character of capitalist expansion, so something similar applies at the international. Far from refuting Marx, the international politics of the 20th century has in fact, I want to argue, played out an enormous human tragedy, which is comprehensible only if we recognize in it the uneven and combined form of capitalist world development. It is, I'm going to suggest, this tragedy of capitalist world development which comprises the lost history of international relations. To see how this is so, we must begin by going back to the historical event which Trotsky's theory was originally formulated to explain, namely, the Bolshevik Revolution itself. We must start by bringing this event back down to earth, by seeing it, as Isaac Deutscher did, not as a bolt of lightning straight out of the pages of Marx onto the open field of history, but rather as an outcome of the international spread of capitalism which had produced the twisted shapes of Tsarism and the international conjuncture of the First World War. And we must remember that according to this theory, the very thing which made Russia the weak link in the chain of European states, namely its relative backwardness and the contradictory effects of combined development, the very same thing also dictated the impossibility of socialism being established in that country. Socialism, after all, is not a free-floating utopia which can be approached from any starting point given only the political will. Marx's whole purpose, it seems to me, was finally to ground this ideal sociologically by identifying the vectors of transformation within the specific characteristics of advanced capitalism. Tsarism, by contrast, could produce insurrections, revolutions even, but not socialism. Any attempt to go further would run up immediately against the political weight of the peasantry, who could certainly be mobilized to overthrow Tsarism, but who would resist their own dissolution through collectivization and industrialization to the bitter end. In other words, the so-called scissors crisis of the late 1920s, in which the antagonism between town and country deepened and whose persistence eventually triggered the new course which was later known as Stalinism, that crisis was not an unforeseen contingency which dropped out of nowhere. Its inevitability, or something like it, was written clearly in the structural coordinates and political sociology of the revolution itself, and was clearly foreseen and prepared for in Trotsky's account of permanent revolution. I say prepared for. What I mean is that the Bolshevik leaders saw this contradiction at the heart of their project, and they placed their hope in a German revolution, which would somehow rescue them before the political imperatives of backwardness strangled the revolution from within. As Lenin put it, at all events, under all conceivable circumstances, if the German revolution does not come, we are doomed. Well, it didn't. And they were. And that, surely, is the first thing we would have to say about the historical meaning of Stalinism. And that is why when Deutsche described Stalinism as the amalgam of Marxism with Russia's primordial and savage backwardness, this was not just a political slogan. It wasn't a piece of personal invective against Stalin himself. It was a basic intellectual precondition for understanding what the Soviet Union was and became. The political shockwaves generated by the Bolshevik Revolution traveled far and wide. They resonated especially through the turmoil which gripped Central and Eastern Europe in the years after the First World War. But what magnified the intensity of their impact there was not just the geographical proximity of these countries to Soviet power. It was also the structural similarity deriving from parallel experiences of combined development which made these societies far more sensitive and vulnerable in the post-war turmoil to the destabilizing effects of the Bolshevik Revolution. And above all, in this context, one begins to appreciate the uniquely fraught condition of Germany in this interwar period, caught between victorious liberal powers in the West and the earthquake shaking it from below in the East. A society whose own peculiar pattern of combined development had crystallized a strong military aristocratic definition of the state and a politically weak bourgeoisie. A society whose belated political transition to a liberal republic took place after the Great War under conditions of nationalist humiliation and strong working class activism. It's under these conditions of combined development thrown into deep crisis that we start to see that distinctive confluence of hypertrophied nationalism, hysterical anti-communism, and revanchist militarism, which would later find expression in the monstrosity of Nazism. In fact, in a book dedicated to the memory of Isaac Deutscher, the American writer David Horowitz developed these points into an alternative interpretation of the overall historical meaning of the Second World War. Horowitz drew directly on Barrington Moore's classic study of six different historical roads from agrarian societies to the emergence of modern states. Barrington Moore had argued that the emergence of modern societies was an unavoidably violent process because it could not take place without the forcible uprooting and dissolution of the peasantry. What his case studies showed him was that in each case, it was the particular alliance between old and new classes which was formed within the state in order to manage this trauma which decided whether the modern state which emerged would be democratic or authoritarian. Now, it's striking that the political forms of the leading states in the Second World War, liberalism, fascism, and Stalinism, did indeed represent three different outcomes to this historical process of capitalist modernization. But what Horowitz is able to add to Moore's account is the realization that these three outcomes, for all their enormous differences, were actually not separate historical experiences. On the contrary, what he was able to show is that it was only by locating them within the overall process of uneven and combined development that we can fully understand what Stalinism and fascism really were. And if that is so, then the full meaning of the Second World War itself cannot be grasped in terms of an interstate conflict over the balance of power, nor in terms of a contest between separate political ideologies. Rather, it was a struggle over the future of the international system between three antagonistic forms of state, all of which had been thrown up within the same process of capitalist world development. It was, in this respect, an ironing out through war of the accumulated political contradictions which that process had built up within the social structure of humanity. An ironing out which cost that humanity over 50 million lives. Well, a partial ironing out, because although fascism was destroyed, the Soviet Union emerged strengthened from the conflict. And it's the survival of this second antagonistic form of combined development which explains, I think, why the World War was followed immediately by the Cold War. And it was not because the capitalist world now faced an external threat from the spread of socialism. To see it in those terms is, I think, to accept at face value the ideological self-definition of the Cold Warriors themselves. We get a much better sense of what was really going on when we recall that outside the military conquest of Eastern Europe, Soviet expansion took place entirely in the underdeveloped world in the aftermath of decolonization. For the creation of 100-odd new states over a 30-year period didn't simply increase the mathematical complexity of power balancing. This process, decolonization, also generalized across whole regions of the globe and in 100 new ways the classic conditions of combined development. Independent states, locked into the dynamic imperatives of development by their incorporation into the world market and the state system, but based internally on unstable amalgams of capitalist and non-capitalist society, and tending towards more and more authoritarian political forms. In other words, decolonization replaced a world of unsustainable European empires with a state system full of mini-czarisms, any of which might explode and drag other similar states down its new path of combined development. And just as within societies where capitalist relations are weak, the bourgeoisie falls in behind the authoritarian state, so now too, internationally, the dominant liberal powers found themselves supporting dictators in the name of order. So the challenge of post-war American foreign policy, I'm suggesting, was to hold the world market together politically at a time when the accelerating, though uneven, capitalist transformation of third world societies threatened to push more and more of them in the direction of the Soviet road. In fact, I think if we step back and look at the period of American hegemony in the post-war period as a whole, if we look at whether we look at the military occupation of the defeated fascist powers, the bipolar confrontation with the Soviet Union, or the conduct of relations with the Third World, we find that the major social content of American foreign policy in the post-war period was not simply the ordering of anarchy, or the spreading of democracy, or even just the narrow pursuit of economic self-interest. It was the geopolitical management of combined development and its consequences on a world scale. Trotsky actually predicted this international conjuncture of American hegemony, complete with this threefold geopolitical orientation of US foreign policy and paradoxical combination of self-assertion and involuntary imperialist entanglement. It is, he wrote in 1928, precisely the international strength of the United States and her irresistible expansion arising from it that compels her to include the powder magazines of the whole world into the foundations of her structure. The antagonisms between the East and the West, the class struggle in old Europe, the uprisings of the colonial masses, and all wars and revolutions, making her, he said, constantly more interested in the maintenance of order in every corner of the terrestrial globe. which I think, as historical predictions go, has fared pretty well. It was, however, left to Isaac Deutscher to see that prediction come true and to witness it approaching a new bloody climax in the jungles of Vietnam. And it was Deutscher who broadcast from his journalistic and literary watchtower a political commentary resolutely independent of both sides in the Cold War, which continued to interpret contemporary international politics as the ongoing history of uneven and combined development. And that, I suggest, is why we're still remembering Deutscher here tonight. Because that perspective remains the key to the lost history of international relations in our century. The core of that history, I've been arguing, is not simply the defense of the balance of power against a series of bids for world empire. Such an image tells us almost nothing of what these conflicts were about, or where their leading participants, all of them historically new forms of state, came from. On the other hand, nor is the core of this history the triumph of liberalism over external totalitarian competitors. Because as we've seen, neither Stalinism nor fascism and their many variants were really external to the world historical process of capitalist development. On the contrary, it's only by exploring how they grew out of that chaotic process that we can ground our understanding of what they actually were. And yet nor, finally, is it, as Francis Fukuyama once told us, the final defeat of socialism by capitalism, which closes off the future and brings history in the Enlightenment sense to an end. To see it in that last way, paradoxically, is actually to accept the ideological self-definition of Stalinism as socialism. Curious position for an official in the American State Department to adopt. So my argument has been, none of those actually capture for us what the core of the international history of the 20th century has been about. The core of that history, I'm arguing, the lost history, is surely the tragedy of uneven and combined development of capitalism internationally, a development which threw up within its own movement the tormented political forms which liberalism has then confronted as its military competitors. Liberal capitalism, however, cannot evade its responsibility in this process, because of course it has been the dominant liberal powers who have from the start stood at the head of this historical process of capitalist development, who have directed it geopolitically, and who have done most to press it forward, and who have profited most from it. In so doing, they, or rather we, have played our ample part, all too easily concealed by the uneven and combined character of the historical process in making all this happen, and thereby in realizing, on a scale which Marx himself could never have imagined, his grim prophecy: if money comes into the world with a congenital bloodstain on one cheek, capital comes dripping from head to toe, from every pore, with blood and dirt. The disastrous conflicts of 20th century world politics, despite all appearances, do not lie outside this coming of capital into the world. On the contrary, they are the historical form which its uneven and combined international development has taken. So where, then, does this leave the theory of the balance of power? I'd like to take a couple of minutes just to clarify the overall status of my argument. The invisible hand of the market did not disappear from the imagination of economists as a result of Marx's theory of value. In a similar way, balance of power calculations were often absolutely central to the events that I've been discussing, and they're not going to disappear from international relations as a result of the theory of uneven and combined development. That's not my claim. The reason for this is that the invisible hand and the balance of power are not, after all, fictions. They are metaphors. Metaphors for the peculiar, impersonal forms through which our collective human agency is expressed in the historical world of capitalism. If and when they do disappear, therefore, it will be through a process of social transformation, not one of cognitive reformulation. But just as economic theories, which took the invisible hand for granted, could never discover the social foundations of capital, so too an international theory based on critically on the balance of power will never show us the human social content of world politics. On the contrary, if we take these metaphors at face value, if we make them the starting point for our social theories, then precisely because they already reflect our historical agency back to us in a mystified form, any social science which we build upon them will only complete the mystification. And it's that which entails that the balance of power theory must not any longer be the integrating, overarching theory for international relations. Not the masterpiece of the discipline, but imprisoning it within an impoverished conception of reality and condemning it to languish in that state of intellectual and moral emaciation which Martin White reported. Intellectually demoted, removed from the central defining apex of the discipline. In its place, we need a conception which incorporates the international dimension of modern world history at the center of its understanding, but which does not do so by abstracting the international from its dynamic, historical, and sociological integument. And that, I suggest, nothing more and nothing less, is the promise of the Marxist idea of uneven and combined development for the discipline of international relations. And what, finally, of its promise for Marxism itself and for our present generation, which stands in the uncertain light of this post-Cold War world? At the end, with a recollection and a prediction. Speaking to a student audience here at the LSE in 1965, towards the end of his life, Isaac Deutscher tried to disentangle in the minds of his listeners the original meaning of the Marxist anticipation of socialism from the vulgar parody to which the tragedy of the Soviet experience had temporarily reduced it. With great eloquence and clarity, he patiently explained, no doubt for the thousandth time, why a revolution in a backward country could not produce on its own a socialist society. He outlined what enormous distortions and inversions of classical Marxist thought had been required in order to appropriate that heritage for such a revolution and to legitimate that revolution. And he analyzed the regressive and paradoxical impact that all this had had on the intellectual and political development of Western Marxism. Not the least part of this, of course, was the suppression of the theory of uneven and combined development itself, which could have made historical and sociological sense of the distortions which Marxism was at that time experiencing. I wonder, did that audience, as he spoke those words, begin to unthink the monolithic ideological assumptions which dominated the Cold War world into which they'd been born? Did they, as I do when I read his speech 30 years later, glimpse the foundation of a completely alternative history of the 20th century, the real historical sociology of its uneven and combined development, which has lain all these years beyond the intellectual reach of both liberalism and Stalinism. As he drew to the end of his speech, Deutsche turned to the future. "You, and people of your generation," he said, "should look wholeheartedly to a time when Marxism will no longer be the Marxism with which we had to live. The Marxism projected through the prism of backwardness, of backward civilization and backward societies." Well, that time has now come. Not, to be sure, in the way that Deutsche would have wanted it, because he never gave up his hope that the Soviet Union and Maoist China would somehow reform themselves into communist democracies. But come it has. And that surely is where we stand today. For it now falls to the present generation of socialists to find, in Deutsche's phrase, a new Marxism in our time, just as it falls to the present generation of international theorists to reincorporate into our understanding of the present that lost world history of the 20th century. If there's any sense to what I've been arguing this evening, then these two tasks will be closely linked, and the theory of uneven and combined development will be central to both of them. And for that reason, I end with the prediction that the name of Isaac Deutsche, who sustained this perspective through the dark, Manichaean years of the Cold War, will, in their aftermath, find new honor.
Giving away any secrets or engaging in lèse majesté if I say that it's often the case that those who receive prizes take the occasion of the speech to reflect with well-justified contentedness on the work which they have already done, but to take the occasion of the award of the prize to lay out a program of work which will keep the speaker and many others busy for many a generation is certainly an appropriate response to the challenge. We have a few minutes for questions. We'd like to kick off.
Well, as I understand it, given an unwarranted assumption, that was a reason to do it. Let's start off. The theory of unequalism winds up into that as an evolution of capitalism. The first question is, when did therefore world capitalism begin? Do you know if you don't have a whether they were the 20th century, 18th century, 19th century, and the rest of the world? That if world capitalism makes a great expansion, how come that so many of the countries which were run by slaves run controlled capitalism didn't develop their economy? The third question is quite how does this theory explain, say, the wars between Vietnam and Cambodia, the wars between communist communities, or the strikes in modern Yemen, Grenada,
it doesn't explain everything, Geoffrey. Well, of course, it doesn't explain anything, but we might use it to explain things. I guess there are three points there. First of all, when do we date the beginning of this historical process from? Well, Geoffrey, as I'm sure... you're aware, this is a matter of enormous and ongoing scholarly debate. I mean, for my purposes, you could assume that I'm going with Eric Hobsbawm's account of this in The Age of Revolution, which sees the dual revolution, the French Revolution and the Industrial Revolution, not as the absolute beginning, but as a moment when a lot of things came together and suddenly this became an unstoppable global process. So, more or less from the end of the 18th century is when we could start talking about this. Secondly, why didn't some of the imperial powers successfully develop their colonies? I mean, I would have thought that was the whole point of the argument, precisely that producing capitalism in a non-capitalist world, in a non-European cultural environment, is not just a straightforward affair, and that actually, despite in some cases enormous efforts to uproot peasantries and turn them into paid labour forces, it actually proved a very uneven historical experience as to where they were able. Yes. Geoffrey, this is not this is not saying that there haven't been other empires in history. It's saying that there's something fundamentally different about the empires that have brought the modern international system into being. Thank you. In the first case, I agree with you when you say that, to some extent, this takes matters out of the province of international theory. But I don't think it takes it into any other branch of theory. I think it leads us back into history and into an actual empirical reconstruction of what happened. I don't think it's possible for there to exist any social theory which can, as it were, produce history out of itself. I think that all of these theories are simply tools that we take to the historical process in order to try and make sense of it. Secondly, I don't know how to explain why it should be that in comparative politics there should be a vote for ignoring the international context of national paths of development, because it seems, if that is the case, because it seems such an obviously important dimension of any country's development. I mean, in the cases that I was looking at this evening, Germany and Russia were the two cases whose combined development under particular international circumstances has had the most disastrous and tumultuous consequences for Western history in the 20th century. It's just inconceivable that one could explain either fascism or Stalinism without that international context. Right. Yeah. I think I agree with that, because in the end it's going to be an empirical question about what we discover the actual interrelations are internationally. So it's not something I'd want to insist on, as it were, as a theoretical premise. Very good question. Yeah. Yes. Perhaps I should say that I think the question is a very important question, isn't it? Is it possible to extract the theory of uneven and combined development as a historiographical heuristic from the broader revolutionary politics of Trotsky, right? And in particular from the theory of permanent revolution? And my feeling about that, and I don't mean to be frivolous when I say this, is that it's not me who is separating those two things. It is actually the history of the last 80 years that has done that. What I mean by that is that even within the theory of permanent revolution, enormous social upheaval was envisaged in the necessary conflict that was going to arise, divergence of interest between the urban working class and the peasant majority of the Russian population. And so far as I understand it, in the end, the whole possibility of that conflict turning out without degenerating into something like we did experience in the form of Stalinism was actually dependent on a reading of the international conjuncture. It was dependent on the belief that was, of course, universal among that generation of Bolsheviks, that they were simply lighting the fuse for a world revolution which was coming under its own steam anyway and was coming very soon. Now, it does seem to me that we've got a verdict of history to interpret there concerning their reading of Western, the development of Western capitalism. And I've thought about this, and the conclusion that I've come to is that this idea, the premise that Western capitalism was ripe for revolution, which in the end is what the entire theory of permanent revolution hangs on. How shall I put it? Two world wars, a disastrous collapse in the international economy, a horrendous rise of fascism, Nazism. If all that wasn't enough to tip over these societies that supposedly were ripe for revolution, that supposedly were just sitting on the verge of transformation into socialism, then I guess it was a mistake to think that they were on the verge of revolution. Now, in fact, I think that it's not an original view at all, but that the Bolsheviks persistently and symptomatically misread Western politics. They projected onto it the brittleness of political forms, which they knew from their own experience. And I don't mean that they weren't deeply absorbed in the international culture of Marxism of their day, but I do think that insofar as that revolution rested on a reading of what was happening in the West, which they were all explicit about, they were wrong. That was a misreading, or at least I don't know what other conclusion to draw. Sure. Yeah.
And a little bit more than that, we have to say that no way out of the That is the only, that's the logic of what
is
you're
it?
Saying.
I thought the logic.
What you're doing, yeah. Take that modern intellectual idea and end up with the academic stuff.
I thought. Yeah.
The colleagues are after you tonight, didn't we?
Well, I thought that the logic of that position was that when we think about socialism today, we are now in a position to disentangle that from the historical experience of what happened in the East, and that in doing so, we are, after all, returning to the original geographical identification of where socialism is a sociological possibility, namely within capitalism. And it does seem to me that if you can't ground of progressive politics within the inherent contradictions of liberal capitalism, then it's not clear to me why a progressive politics rooted in any other kind of society anywhere in the world is actually going to lead to socialism. I can see how it leads to all kinds of other things, but it does seem to me that the whole geographical reorientation of socialist hope that went with the theory of permanent revolution, and which ended up, of course, exiled to the fringes of third world revolutions, has actually been a historical detour. It's my personal view. Let me try and say again, perhaps a bit more clearly, what I was saying at the end about what I take to be the overall status of my argument. I'm not arguing that states don't engage in a balance of power, that they don't maneuver, construct alliances, and break them when they're interesting tape, and so on. And clearly, that there was a gyration of that kind going on between these three parties that were central to the Second World War. So I'm not... My problem with balance of power theory is not that I'm arguing that powers don't balance in the international system. It's that I don't think that theory on its own actually explains where these things come from, what they're fighting over, and why the outcome goes the way that it does. And in the case of the Second World War, what I think this theoretical approach does explain is why the Second World War was immediately followed by the Cold War. Balance of power theory does it in a different way, which says that the victors always fall out, because there is a disequilibrium of power then to resolve. But, you know, we're not going to explain the Cold War like that, are we, Jeffrey? Even you wouldn't explain the Cold War like that. Basically orchestrated. Right. I think, in the first place, the central historical episode which I was looking at this evening, namely the World Wars, are of course not about North-South relations. I mean, I was trying to say something about how understanding of the uneven and combined character of capitalist development would have eventuated in those conflicts within the core that there is uneven and combined development within the advanced capitalist world, as well as outside it, and whether that has now been, as it were, fully ironed out, is a historical question. We'll have to wait and see. On the question of how you would use it to explain relations among advanced capitalist countries, I'm not quite clear what the specific difficulties with that would be, because this theory is, of course, itself located within a broader conception of the capitalist world market as being the fundamental site of the organization of social power in the modern world. And the claim, therefore, that, or rather the prospect of intercapitalist competition within the core of that world market doesn't seem to me to raise any special problems for this theory, but perhaps I'm misunderstanding the point of the question. Sorry.
No.
Well, I mean,
thanks for a very unsectarian question.
I think that Marx's analysis in Capital is actually astonishingly apposite. That in Volume 1 of Capital, which of course doesn't have any discussion of revolution. It's a short chapter towards the end, but there is no substantive, as it were, identification of how the socialist revolution is going to come about. But what there is there, of course, is an immensely profound analysis of why it is that the historical form of society in which we live, namely capitalism, is itself incapable of preventing its own expansion, and is incapable of adjusting its own chaotic mechanisms of growth, except retrospectively through a kind of rhythmical process of boom and recession and so on. And the identification of what it is about the basic social relations that constitute our modern capitalist societies, which on the one hand gives them this enormous technological and geographical dynamism, but on the other hand leads them necessarily into competitive conflict with each other, seems to stand, you know, irrespective of any advance that Trotsky may have made with the theory of uneven and combined development. Yes. We'll discuss. discuss it later. I think I really thought of that.
Okay, but it was just like...
I'd like to start by saying that this is one of the most heartening of things that I've heard from the beginning of another really amazing career. I'd like to say that I think that there is a further step that one can take with respect to this basic problem, with respect, I think, specifically to what it can do for international relations. You've talked about the emergence of the Cold War and the end of the Second World War. What one also has to look at the end of the Second World War is the emergence of systems which were precisely designed to deal with what was seen very clearly by the leading interventions in the United States as to be the problem that capitalism was going to face when it's not going to start the Third World War. Look at what Keynes and White were saying in the lead-up to Brexit. There was a very, very clear statement there, which is uncontrolled capitalism, no effective international mechanism for intervention, control the weak systems of weak states being now conceded in their existence to the strong states would necessarily lead to the kind of autarkic process which generated fashion. Because I think one can start by saying that one can understand combined development not just in the way but also combined development is a sense of that one exists the necessity for capitalist expansion. Now if we have a world market, the only possibility of sustaining stability in the individual state is if that world market operates in an even way. And the basic market argument that uncontrolled capitalism necessarily doesn't reduce the concentration of centralization. And this was seen by Keynes, not necessarily a Marxist, as the result of processes that occurred in the international period when Germany was forced into unemployment and unemployment created tension. The IMF and the World Bank had set up precisely in order to deal with that problem. And what now interests me is that I work in Africa, which is the area par excellence that has characteristics of human struggle. And there is not a single state in Africa, possible except for South Africa, which is not now being semi-governed by the World Bank and the IMF. Now, any notion of balance of power between autonomous and sovereign states has no meaning when countries are no longer able to make autonomous decisions and are indeed for their survival on external intervention, both in money and specifically in policy. Now this is certainly combined with Germany and Africa. In 1967, when I sat in Flanders University looking at what was happening to the Labour government, who was it that came in 1967 and laid down a programme for the Labour government which then in 1970 and again in 1976 for the IMF? In other words, uneven development creates the necessity for international intervention in non-competitive and generates a form of global government. And it seems to me that that issue is very central to an understanding of the international system in the 1990s, when indeed the whole of Eastern Europe is being managed precisely through the mechanisms of international intervention, which are required for defense and technology. There are now five countries that are gross national product has declined by 60% in the last 4 years. These countries are being governed and directed by the World Bank. Unless you understand these processes in this way, I can't see that you can say anything sensible about the international system.
I have a lot of sympathy with that.
Sorry, no, the guy on the left. Okay, two more questions.
Okay.
the whole characterization of the situation you done a lot by LA, remember, Javier, so a lot of officers that he led in and came out of peril, people know, kind of a postological thing. And so, I mean, in a way, there's no sense of time, and I think, well, and for example, that is what it takes to clearly, in order to get some safe offices, as well as the state houses,
that for me the great virtue of this approach, uneven combined development, is that it enables me to try and think through something which is very contradictory about the modern world, which is that we live in a world in which a large number of societies which, previous to the modern epoch, were not profoundly linked to each other. There may have been communication between them, but they were not integrated, have been incorporated within a single political economy, just to put it as boldly as that. And the paradox is, or at least the thing that is difficult to sort of think through, is that this means that at one and the same time you have a real material unity of human social development, but they still are separate countries. It counts for something that these are societies which emerge from different histories and which retain separate political authority, however much that may have been officiated in certain circumstances. And it is the compulsive forms of development which societies under those conditions are driven into, and the dangerous forms of political superstructure that emerge on the basis of that, that it seems to me is so clearly pointed to by this theory, that using this you can start to see how at one and the same time it is a, as they used to say, a contradictory unity. And you can actually cash that out in empirical terms and understand, on the one hand, that the international system really is unstable because it contains such incredible unevenness of human social development forced together. And on the other hand, individual societies simply do not any longer have any history of separate development. It seems to me that that's the form of the question that we can't avoid having to try and make sense of if we're going to have a theory of international relations. That at the same time, we need to see both how these things are linked together and how they're separate within that. That's what attracts me about Trotsky's intellectual framework.
Here we have the West there, I think. Talking of contradictory unities, there are a few contradictory unities, like the audience of the Nazi Deutsche Memorial lecture, and I think we've seen that this evening in grand form. On behalf of all of you, I'd like to thank Justin very much indeed for a very stimulating lecture, for a very stimulating book, and for the promise of many an idea and argument to come. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah.
to get Jeffrey out of the way at the beginning.
Yes, yes,
yes, yes, yes, yes. Fire his shot.
Do you think there's such a thing as the American Empire?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Why do you not mention the First World War in your talk? Isn't that a fairly crucial turning point?
Yes, it is. I couldn't mention everything. But I agree with you.
Do you think that decolonization really took place, or was that just a kind of colourful phrase that people use?
Decolonization. I think it did and it didn't.
Very good.
There's some drinks up this coming up. Sort of in the front door and up on the right.
Have you seen it?
Very loud. Yeah, my task.
I must go and think about myself. But wonderful. I mean, congratulations. I will speak to you soon.
Right.